Welcome to The Doctor Is Out, a podcast hosted by Sharif Vakili, investor at Polaris Partners and primary care physician at Stanford. Join Sharif in exploring the extra clinical practice of medicine as he interviews healthcare leaders who have gone from bedside to build companies, run health systems, spearhead public policy, and pursue many other paths where they lend their unique bedside perspectives.
Our guest today is geriatrician and a CEO of WellBe Senior Medical, Dr. Jeffrey Kang. We have such a cool guest on today's podcast. He is a geriatrician, which I think is the coolest specialty, the first chief medical officer of CMS, the former chief medical officer of Cigna, a former executive at Walgreens and ChenMed, and now the founder and CEO of at-home geriatric primary care startup WellBe. Dr. Jeffrey Kang, thank you so much for taking the time to join us on the podcast today.
Sharif, it's my pleasure. I actually, quite frankly, always love speaking to physicians and frequently asked to mentor, so I'm really looking forward to this.
Appreciate that, Jeff. Jeff, could you just share a little bit about your background for the audience? How did you get to where you were? How did you go from your clinical interests to now leading so many organizations, both in the public sector side and the private sector, and now as an entrepreneur?
I should just say one thing. Part of the problem is I have a hard time keeping one job. So I'll try to go through the history as best as I can. For 10 years, I practiced clinical medicine as a geriatrician up in Boston. You know, I was on the faculty at the Beth Israel Hospital, one of the Harvard teaching hospitals. But the what was interesting in that 10 years, I ran a group called the Urban Medical Group. And we were practicing...
It's Commonwealth Care Alliance.
It was the progenitor for Commonwealth Care Alliance, absolutely.
With Lori Tischler, I think there's amazing.
Yeah, so in fact, I'm still in touch with Bob Master, the former CEO of another physician leader you should have on your call, actually, or your podcast. But what I like to, as a geriatrician, we were practicing, I would say, patient-centered care, clinical care, value-based care from a clinical perspective. But the biggest challenge was you could not make it really work in fee-for-service. And so that's kind of, and we started off there because it was the right thing to do from a clinical perspective. And we would see patients in their home, keep them out of the emergency room. We'd spend all this time, but we wouldn't get any reimbursement from a physician's, from a financial perspective. That then led me to say, the only way we're going to get this care, this, let's call it correct patient-centered value-based care to scale, is you had to go to the payer side. You had to change payment policy. So I ended up going, applying for a White House fellow, a lot of clinician leadership's a White House fellow. And then just over time, ended up at CMS, as you said, the first chief medical officer for CMS for Clinton and Bush. I think one of the key things that we did there, which has just essentially completely changed the Medicare and Medicare Advantage program, three key things. Number one is my team created the risk adjustment methodology, which we can talk
about. Wow, that's amazing.
We created the HCC risk adjustment methodology, and we'll talk more about that.
So you're at fault for all that drama. No, I'm joking.
That's, what's that? It has dramatically changed, I think, favorably the industry.
Yes.
Now, there are some other issues around overpayment, but if you just step back globally, it really changed the face of the industry, and now we can talk about that. Second thing we did was CAPS. We created the Consumer Assessment Health Plan Survey and the Medicare and Medicaid HEDIS. So that became your performance measurement system that's underneath all of Medicare. And then third thing we did was we actually created the progenitor, which eventually came ONC. So it was about health information sharing, and interoperability. Those three key structural things, I think, from a payer's perspective, launched a lot of the movement to value-based care. You needed to fix those things on the payer side. We'll spend more time on that. Then I went to Cigna, as you said, for 9 years. So I certainly understand the commercial side, stood up their collaborative care organizations, et cetera. I don't want to bore you there. Once all the payers started moving in this value-based direction, the reality is the value was created by the provider. So then I went back and I switched to the provider side. So at Walgreens, I was responsible for all their clinics, 800 clinics around the country, 400 in the stores, 400 at employer campuses. So, and the goal there was to create one big primary care network from a wall. And we'll spend some time, we can spend some time talking about Walgreens. Then, as you said, went to Chen Med. I was the president of Chen Med. So one of the, I think, one of the industry leading, you know, value-based organizations. And now the CEO and founder of WellBe Senior Medical. And the easiest way of thinking about WellBe Senior Medical is think about it as a Chen Med or Oak Street, but for the really sick people. And instead of having the patients come into the clinic, we take the care to the patients. That's it. So, but the financing mechanism is the same, 100% global risk, upside and downside. So anyway, that's the arc of my career. Think about it as I'm the provider, then, but we couldn't make it work in fee for service. If you did the right thing, switch to the payer side, both Medicare, Medicaid, you know, commercial, then back to the provider side. Now that we got the whole value-based movement going.
Jeff, I hope that's amazing. I hope the audience appreciates I'm talking to literally one of the architects of our health system in this country.
Like, well, I don't think it's just me. I think there's a lot of other people that follow, like a Don Berwick, and you know, but let's say we put a lot of the foundational pieces in place.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing. I mean, there's so much to dig into there. Were you at Walgreens the same time Pat Carroll was there? Were you involved with some of the same projects? I mean, we had him on the podcast too.
Yeah. So Pat was the medical director for the retail clinics in the stores. He and I don't know if I should share this, is another discussion, but he and I were there during the whole Theranos thing. We could talk a little bit about that. But Pat's a great physician, great physician leader.
Yeah. Wow. I can't imagine. And then were you guys involved also in the VillageMD acquisition too, and thinking about that?
Yeah, so that actually came after my time.
Okay.
But maybe I'll give you a little bit of a history here, just a bit, if I look at it from a Walgreens perspective. Walgreens, prior to the acquisition of, with or the merger with Alliance Boots, was heading down. So this would have been the mid like teens of 2015 or so, was headed down, clearly getting into primary care, 400 clinics in the stores, 400 clinics on employer campuses. When the Alliance Boots acquisition occurred, they had a very different view that they did not like the healthcare space, and they actually wanted to get into, they thought they were going to win in retail pharmacy and beauty. So they basically, my last 6 months there was unwinding all, we stood up three ACOs, we kind of, but unwinding all the retail clinics, we sold the worksite clinics to Water Street, turns out, which, and it's now owned by OMERS, the Toronto private equity kind of thing. But anyway, unwinding all that, roll the clock forward, leadership realized they couldn't win in beauty. So now they're going back to healthcare, and then you have the VillageMD acquisition.
That's so interesting.
So there's a history here. There's a cycle, but I actually think, you know, from their perspective, the retail space has largely become a commodity, but then how do you take advantage of the entire footprint and the healthcare presence to actually, to go, you know, to create other value. You know, so now you got Walgreens doing VillageMD, and now you actually have CVS acquiring Oak Street. So,
yeah, exactly.
I think there's another way from a retail health perspective, from a retail pharmacy perspective, you can think about this, is retail pharmacy is really so downstream from everything. You know, basically they're filling the prescriptions that are ordered by doctors and everything. In order to kind of create more value, they have to move upstream. And there are two ways of moving upstream. One is to get control or have ownership in the physician prescribing. So Village MD, Oak Street. The second is to acquire a plan, the payer. And that's what CVS has done. CVS acquired Aetna, right? And so I think in order to add that, you just have to capture the value and add value at multiple different levels. And preferably, you really need to be upstream of everything, not downstream.
Yeah, that makes sense. You have more control too that way in changing how the delivery model works.
And the physician, you and your physician audience will appreciate this. You know, you've probably heard this. The most expensive device, the medical device in this country, is the doctor's pen. That is the most expensive device in because the physician is ordering what gets utilized, what gets used, where it gets utilized. You control the physician pen, then you control the utilization of resources.
Absolutely. Especially the primary care pen, sort of the node for a lot of that. Yeah.
I'm talking to an internist, so you're speaking my language here. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Jeff, you know, I think that it's key and critical that this is appreciated in all medical education, all medical training. I have fought so hard to try to see if my own residency training program at Stanford for the prices of everything to be listed. I don't think anybody knows, even from a training to staff level, what kind of payment schema our patients in. The fact that Stanford is starting to build its own ACO network, and anyway, it's just, I think it needs to really go deep so that we can react. At least that's my thought. That's my hope. Obviously, I'm very biased. I walk on this stuff all day.
I think you're right. I don't think physicians completely understand the value they could or could not, can or cannot create. They really don't. The hospitals get it. I think the hospitals have figured out that they're just a place where stuff gets done. But at the end of the day, they just need the physicians to be affiliated with the hospital. The hospitals are all over this thing, but they're just a place where stuff gets done. They're not really. It's all about the doctors.
I like that a lot. That is so true. That is so true. Where do they...
I hope there are no hospital executives in your audience. But anyway, but that's, I think they figured that out. And that's why
I don't think that's, I don't think they would push back on that. I mean, there's truth to that. Where do you think home-based primary care fits in this model, you know, upstream, downstream? What do you see, Walgreens or CVS getting interested in this space eventually in their local communities?
Yeah, so I think on the home-based primary care, so again, Wellbe Senior Medical is a home-based, basically take care of the 10-15% of the sickest, and we basically bring primary care into their home. That's it. From a clinical perspective, that's simple. And you'll appreciate this as an internist. 90-95% of what you do in a doctor's office can be done at home, right? You can take a history, do a physical exam, draw a blood test, do an electrocardia, do ultrasounds, take plan. I'm using 90-95% of you, what you do is can be done at home. So I think the upstream downstream issue is not the clinical model. The upstream downstream question is related to whether you are a fee for service provider or whether you're value based. So Wellbe is 100% value based. We take 100% global capitation, full risk for all of the services, hospital, emergency room specialist, Part D drugs, et cetera. We're 100% at risk for that. We're the payer. And then if we actually can't reduce utilization, we lose money. Okay. The way I like to think about it is our goal is to keep people healthy and out of the hospitals, and then I make money. Okay. But it's not fee for service. It's not a volume play. It's really helping people improve outcomes, keep them healthy and out of the hospital. Okay. But when you think about it, we're essentially a pay provider then. I don't know if you heard this, but we're both the payer and the provider. That's how you're moving upstream. And it's the economic model. It's not the fact that I'm in home doing private. And there, I have a lot of colleagues who are doing, trying to do this in fee for service. But I would, at the end of the day, say that they're really not upstream. There's so much more I can do now that I'm a paid provider. I can give you some examples, but the it is different being both the payer and the provider.
Yeah, it's definitely the future. I mean, I think CMS recently, they had their 2024 guidance. They want everybody to be an ACO REACH on full, I don't know, was it their target on full risk by 2030? That just seems wild, but this has to be the path forward for that. Yeah. One thing I'm wondering, Jeff.
Just one thing on that, just because.
Yeah, please.
Now this is a former CMS official talking, but
please, yeah.
Remember Sylvia Burwell? So this was under Obama, actually. So this would have been Secretary Burwell. This would have been almost 12 years ago. And she had predicted at that time that 80 or 90% of care would be in some sort of value-based model in 5 to 10 years. I have to be honest, we've fallen short, number one.
Yeah.
And number two, this really gets to how do you define value-based care?
Yeah.
I do not think a ACO model where the ACO is protected from the downside and has some upside gain share, I do not think that is true value-based care.
Yeah. There was actually this question that I asked Pat of, where do you see within the health system value-based care being used for window dressing versus actually fundamentally changing the way clinical medicine is practiced and innovating there?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Window dressing plus creating integrated networks, but it's still window dressing.
Yes, yes, exactly. Just acquiring and bundling.
Yeah. It really is at the end of the day, if you're prepared to take downside risk from a provider perspective, is probably where the cutoff is. And if you use that, I think, no offense to CMS, but I think they're going to fall short.
Yeah, yeah. Well, okay, so then playing devil's advocate, we also hear a lot about how you don't want to take on risk too early. You're just, you know, going to, if you raise a ton of money and you own a bunch of patients and you go fully at risk right now, you'll, you know, go fast and burn out. If you mess up somewhere, it's just very risky. Start out fee for service, smaller population, prove out your model, scale out. This also has implications on different ways of financing startups in this space. Curious how you sort of reconcile these tensions to create something truly innovative.
So I actually think so. Maybe if I use Wellbe as an example, but also you could talk about Oak Street or ChenMed for the matter, is they went full risk out of the gate. The difference, quite frankly, you already alluded to it, is they had access to capital. I think clinicians could go full risk out of the gate and if they had adequate access to capital. And I actually think physicians would prefer if their entire practice was full risk. I'm sure you've heard this from your other speakers, but the conundrum that physicians have is when half their practice is fee for service, half their practice is some value-based thing, and they do not, and I personally don't like to practice differently depending upon who's paying the bill.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
I actually think this is more, I think we have the ability, knowledge, and know-how. At the end of the day, I think this is a capital problem.
That's so interesting. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, because you need something
just
like...
Just as an aside, yeah. I know you work for Polaris, but I mean, somehow the private equity people are kind of the bad guy in this. The reality is the private equity people are forming a function, which is to help on the capital side. So,
yeah, yeah, yeah. As long as they're not, what was it? We also had Elizabeth Rosenthal. We were talking about the gamesmanship on intentional out of network billing. Is another playbook,
right?
yeah, but obviously, you know, there's ways to be made money in healthcare and value based care. The hope is with all of the infrastructure that you and your team set up, that what's profitable is what's best for the health system. Actually, on that topic, we had Don Berwick on the podcast about a year ago. We were talking about the, you know, nuts and bolts, if you will, of how we are capturing risk in our population and appropriately financing and resourcing care, and specifically the HCC coding. And he had a particular take on it and talked about some of the cautions around HCC overcoding and the cost of care, Medicare Advantage, for example, compared to traditional Medicare historically. And you had a response to his health affairs piece, which I think is so cool to have you here. Could you share a little bit with the audience about your perspective on that and how we move forward in being able to appropriately capture, you know, risk for patients, finance care, and then make it so that it's not burdensome on the physician so they can just do their work and not get split in different directions?
So I wouldn't mind if you, as part of this podcast, you put a URL to my health affairs.
Oh, I absolutely will. Absolutely. But, we did it last time for Balance Here. Everyone should read it.
I do know, actually, I do know Don pretty well. And we're actually pretty close friends. I think the, I guess I should say pretty close friends, but we know each other well. I do think he did something right to bring to light this issue of quote overcoding. I think that's appropriate from a public policy perspective. Where I actually disagree with him is I don't think it's an overcoding issue in Medicare Advantage. I think it's really an undercoding issue in traditional Medicare fee-for-service. And the reasons are simple. In Medicare fee-for-service, you can put any diagnosis on a claim and get paid. What CMS cares about is the CPT code.
And
I make a point of this in the article. You could have literally have a patient with 10 chronic diseases, one of them being diabetes, and all you have to do is just put diabetes on the bill, even though you're seeing them for HIV, heart failure, whatever. You put diabetes on the bill, and that's it. And all you all they care about is the CPT code and what's the level. In fact, that's
maybe for our guests, because some of our guests are medical trainees and know nothing about billing. We just say a word on like what is a CPT code.
Oh, okay. So CPT is abbreviation for Common Procedural Terminology. So it basically is the inputs. What it's trying to do is measure the inputs of care. How much time you spent? What did you do? Did you do a procedure? Did you take a test? Whatever. That's the inputs of care. It is not a diagnosis.
That's right.
Well, the ICD-10 system is making a diagnosis. And so the risk adjustment in Medicare Advantage is based on the diagnosis. In Medicare fee-for-service, they could care less about the diagnosis. They pay you based on that CPT code. So the reality, actually, what's probably going on now, there is some overcoding going on probably in Medicare, overdiagnosis, let's call it overdiagnosis, going in Medicare Advantage. But the overwhelming majority of the issue is underdiagnosis going in fee-for-service. In fact, I had a very nice, this actually came from Rick Kronick. I quoted him in the article. I knew Rick from ways back, but he did a very intense analysis and said, okay, let me look at the people who had quadriplegia diagnosed this year and then ask the question, was that diagnosis rebilled sometime the next year or subsequent years? And it was only 40%. Now, you and I know that quadriplegia did not go away. That quadriplegia from your medical, non-medical people is chronic paralysis of all four limbs. That did not go away. That's what happens in fee for service.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And you make the point too. Because then, well, maybe share for the audience the solution you suggested that would allow a physician, no matter what, you know, if they're practicing fee for service or managed care or both, they'll just be able to not worry about it and diagnose accurately.
I think this is interesting. We got to go back to the purpose of risk adjustment first, and then I'll go to. So in Medicare Advantage, the policy issue we were wrestling with 20 or 30 years ago when we created this HCC methodology was we were paying health plans the same thing, regardless if the patient was healthy or sick. In that system, the health plans incentive to skim the healthy. And they would basically do crazy things like they take their enrollment centers, put them on a third floor walk up, break the elevator. And if the patient could walk up, you know, three flights, that was your exercise stress test and they were good and we'll enroll them. So, so that was the public policy issue. And I think everyone agreed back then that that does not add value to the healthcare system.
Yeah.
Just skimming the healthy, right? So we came up with this idea to pay plans based on the risk, the disease burden, you know, that they that the patients had. People with six or seven chronic disease got paid more than the healthy golfer who has no chronic diseases. Makes sense. Now, and by doing that, you ended up now with a lot of growth in Medicare Advantage, but they actually now started taking sick people and creating management around it. So then you got like PACE programs and WellBees and Chen Meds and Oak Street, whatever. So, okay. That was the public policy rationale. It actually turns out there were the same arguments in fee-for-service. Hospitals would say, okay, wait a second. I'm getting paid the same DRG for a total hip for a recently retired golfer versus someone who has rheumatoid arthritis, congestive heart failure, COPD. Shouldn't we be risk adjusting DRGs? You know, and it's actually the same argument in physicians' offices. So I think one of the right thing to do from a care perspective and a physician perspective is we actually begin to introduce risk adjustment based on diseases in the traditional Medicare fee-for-service system. And then all of a sudden, if you have doctors to, you know, writing, getting the diagnosis, collecting it, and then getting paid kind of on a risk-adjusted basis a little more because someone is sick, that's a clinically coherent activity. Think about it. I now have created a system where the doctors are get incentive to record a diagnosis and take care of the patient. That actually adds that adds some value versus correct CPT coding on the inputs of care adds no value whatsoever.
That is so interesting. Going back to a point we were making early on, Jeff, do you think something like that would be an accelerant to go towards the full capitated risk model from fee-for-service or actually create less incentives to do so because, you know, you can just be in that fee-for-service world and try to do the right thing.
I think it's an accelerant. So for example, if you had someone from a FQHC here, Philly Quality Health Center, they're 95% in fee-for-service, 100% in fee-for-service. And their biggest complaint is I'm taking care of sick people and I'm not getting adequately reimbursed. Or you, if you look at the CMS, there's the disadvantaged hospital, what's it called? They have a special category called, it'll come to me, but they have a special category of hospitals that take a disproportionate share of hospitals that have disproportionate, you know, disadvantaged or located in Harlem, sick people, uninsured people, whatever. They have a special payment methodology for them. But their biggest complaint is I'm taking care of these sickest people and I'm not getting enough reimbursement for it. So I actually think if you begin to introduce risk adjustment with traditional Medicare fee-for-service, I do think that you will see an acceleration of value-based care because now all of a sudden people won't be afraid to take care of sick people.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, you have that information on your population, so you could look back and comfortably know what your care would have looked like if you were fully at risk a little bit better because you have all that coding piece de-risked already.
I mean, just look what's happening in the delivery system. Why do, you know, hospitals and doctor groups set up in suburbia because they're looking for easy people to take care of and still get the same fee for service reimbursement. If you suddenly had adequate reimbursement, you'd be like, okay, I'll open up in, you know, South Side of Chicago. The providers are abandoning the South Side of Chicago because they want the easy people.
Well, I want to use this as a segue to dig into WellBe's model of care and geriatric care, and particularly where we see geriatric care as a resource existing in more urban settings versus less urban settings. Curious how much you think care for seniors needs to be specialized. Like, do you carve out geriatricians and senior health into WellBe and PACE programs and Chen Meds and so forth? Or is there a world for senior health where you just deliver really good care within the traditional primary care infrastructure, maybe with a consultant? How do you think about this from your vantage, especially as a geriatrician?
Yeah, so actually, I don't think there's a world of specialization that's needed here. But I'll explain kind of why. And the simple, this is, I'm also an internist. Really what people are looking for from a care perspective is the full continuum of care, prevention all the way to end of life. And they're really looking for a primary care provider to be their advocate and actually see them, quite frankly, in the clinic, at home, nursing home, or in the hospital. I'm old school, but one of my patients got admitted. I'd see him first in the emergency room. And if they need to be admitted, then I continue to see them in the hospital. That's really the right way to design the system. But it's agnostic to being seniors. In fact, my practice, we were geriatrics initially. When the HIV epidemic occurred, we actually peaked somewhere around 30-40% of our patients were HIV patients under the age of 65. The principle was the same. Full continuum of care, prevention all the way to the end of life, see the patient in various settings, follow them around. So that's the right thing to do, but that's not an age thing or that's not a disease thing. That's just the right thing to do for age regardless. The only reason, quite frankly, why everyone is starting in Medicare Advantage is because of the three things I talked about. There's risk adjustment there. Second is there's quality incentives. We didn't spend much time on CAHPS, but there's quality incentives. And third, there is information sharing because the federal government is pushing that. That really are the three structural things that you need to move this. That is not happening in commercial insurance. And it's beginning to happen in Medicaid. So it's not a care or a clinical issue that why people are focused on seniors. It's a structural payment incentives issue. And you see very little value-based care in the commercial sector, next to none. Yep.
Makes sense. The theme keeps touching upon a lot of parts of what we're talking about today. From a perspective of scalable, then, primary care for seniors, particularly at-home-based primary care, you know, I think it's very easy to see the value prop of, you know, if you have a assisted living facility, 50 to 100 seniors under one roof, having a provider on site or a home-based care solution, you know, making the rounds there. How do we make that scale? How have you thought about that in the larger population?
Yeah, I think now this gets kind of to the operational issues. I do think, WellBe is able to make this work because we're focused on the sickest and because we're 100% value-based. But to give you a sense, in order to make our model work in traditional Medicare fee-for-service, we would have to probably make somewhere around 10 to 12 visits a day. We're currently only doing 4 to 5 visits a day. I shouldn't say only, but that's kind of the right number when you think about how much time you have to spend to the patient. Yeah, so, okay. So I think a lot of the things that you're hearing that's going on in the market is if you kind of fix on that 10 to 12 number in order to make it work in fee for service, what people are doing is trying to find places where people are congregated in an assisted living or whatever. And then they can really begin to potentially see 10 to 12 people a day, you know, so that's kind of what's going on there. Pace, when you're thinking, you mentioned pace, the place of congregation is kind of the adult day, you know.
Right.
But I do think that what's beginning to happen in pace, and by the way, from a scale perspective, if everyone has to have an adult day, that's hard.
Yeah, versus, we were talking about this, like, everyone says PACE is wonderful. Their outcomes are amazing. They've been around. They're like, oh, gee, value-based care. But why hasn't it taken off and been the dominant model? It's like, yeah, good question.
It's really hard. Now, what's beginning to happen in PACE is they're actually beginning to stop the adult, move away from adult day. And they're beginning to say, maybe it's a home buy. I don't need this adult day thing. And then, so to give you some sense of this from a scale, so I used to be a Chen Med. We would talk about a 12 to 15 month window into enter a brand new market, because you had to like build the clinics, you had to, you know, stock them, and you have to actually, you had to go find the place, then build them and remodel it. 12 to 15 months to enter the new market. At Wellbe, since we're not bricks and mortar, 90 days to enter a new market. And so I do think this physical footprint creates barriers to scaling. Now, PACE, I think ultimately you're beginning to see some PACE providers say, do I really need this adult day? Or can I actually contract for it? And then really think about kind of a mix of home. But anyway, so I do think that PACE in the long run will begin to scale faster, let's call it. But right now it's largely a mom and pop, because they're kind of fixated, for lack of a better word, on this adult day footprint.
Interesting. So Wellbe is probably then almost exclusively or focused on virtual care outside of the home visit. Is that fair to say?
When you say virtual, the way I think about it is we are first and foremost in person in the home.
Right.
Then supplemented with telehealth or facilitated telehealth, you know, as needed. But I always let the patient demand drive kind of what's the appropriate intervention. In fact, we also have this interesting paramedic program where if someone calls urgently, I can get a paramedic in to see that patient in 30 minutes. They do the assessment and then we treat them. We start IVs, give them IV ceftriaxone, gentamicin, whatever it is. We've seen a 33% reduction in emergency room visits from that program. But you really let the patient demand drive the appropriate channel, for lack of a better word, you know, and utilization. And whether it's an physical visit with a nurse practitioner or a doctor, or a physical visit with a paramedic, or a telehealth visit, or a telephone call, whatever it is, you let the patient demand and their needs drive that.
How do you think about geographically going after these markets? How much is a factor of these patients being congregated in one area? I don't even know if there's, you think about the node of the health system that's in that market, if there's even overlaps between how hospital at home initiatives are thinking about, you know, geographically having this hub and spoke kind of model.
Yeah. You do need a certain density. So right now we're largely, let's say, for example, in the state of Ohio, we have about almost 40,000 members who are at full risk for. Then if you look at that state, you'll find though it's concentrated in like Cincinnati, Cleveland, Columbus, Dayton, Toledo. We're getting pretty close though to like semi-rural almost, but it's largely, you do need a certain density to kind of make this work. You know, if I have my clinicians driving, you know, 8 hours to do one visit, that's a little tough to make that model work. So, but I think at some point, see, we're payer agnostic. So at some point, if I have multiple payers So for example, I use Ohio's grant. We have three payers. If I get multiple payers there, I think I could achieve density the entire the cover the entire state.
Is it hard to acquire those patients in those marketplaces? Are the local health systems sort of vying for the same base?
Actually, short answer is no. Maybe I should give you just a quick snapshot. Our average patient has 6 to 7 chronic diseases, medical loss ratio greater than 100, medical costs 2 to 3 times higher, incidence of prevalence of schizophrenia 4 times higher, prevalence of dementia 5 times higher, and they're all Medicare. The hospitals do not want these patients. They want a commercial patient and an elective CABG or elective. That's what they want. So the reality actually, and that's by the way, the doctors, let's believe that they don't want the Medicare patients and they don't want the sick Medicare patients.
Yeah, that
So
makes sense. That makes
that's by
sense.
the way, back to my risk adjustment issue. If you're getting paid the same DRG, what would you prefer for your total hip? A recently retired golfer or, someone demented, schizophrenic with 5, 6 chronic diseases and try to do a total hip on them?
Yeah, absolutely. That makes sense. I mean, it's funny, like the saying was, when I always get first getting started in Las Vegas, the case managers were all happy to send over their patients, and then before they knew it, they were out of a job.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. I mean, it's like, I mean, everyone follows their incentives. I don't blame them. But so basically, what's happening in fee for service is everyone's trying to skin the healthy and the people that pay more. The commercial patient pays more.
Yeah. This has been such a wonderful conversation, Jeff. I really appreciate you going so deep into these topics. I want to ask my last question that I ask all our guests on this podcast. I hate to put you on the spot, but just curious if you've encountered anything recently, could literally be anything, a song, a podcast, a TV show, a book. Someone recommended a tricycle one time for their kids. Anything you found interesting or compelling that you'd want to share for our audience?
I was recently, and this will maybe circle back to, but I was recently on a panel of healthcare executives from Medicare Advantage plans, and talking about the history of Medicare and et cetera. And I just asked the question and just said, how much time in the C-suite 20 years ago were you talking about quality and patient satisfaction? And the answer was, 1 hour out of 200 hours. With the advent of CAHPS and HEDIS and STARS, you ask the question today, how much time in the C-suite of a Medicare event are you talking about HEDIS, STARS, quality, et cetera? It's like 40, 50% of the time. That's the power of changing incentives. That is the power in having reportable data. So I'm sorry, it's not very inspirational, but maybe
It's
I just
it absolutely is.
I mean, I think I it's not like I read a great book or something like that, but I just need to when you really step back and kind of look at what happens in Medicare Advantage, all of the innovation that's going on in this country is occurring from a care perspective, from kind of is occurring in Medicare Advantage. And it's because of those three fundamental things. Now, what's interesting is the next place where this is going to happen is Medicaid. The states are moving in this direction. Commercial insurance is going to be the last. And I think we're decades away. But if the show was longer, I think there's a fundamental structural problem. But anyway, but it's going to be Medicare Advantage first, maybe Medicare traditional fee for service, and then kind of get the policy right. Then Medicaid. I think actually Medicaid goes faster than traditional Medicare fee for service, and then public commercials at last.
Wait, I want to double click on that though. Tell me, what was it you teased us? What was it around commercial insurance that is
And geez, I would love
so
to.
recalcitrant?
In a nutshell, people forget that 85% of commercial business is ASO. Used to be 95, but with the Affordable Care Act, it's probably around 85. And when it's the ASO, the health plan does not have any incentives at all. They're just being paid for third-party administration. All the savings are going to the employers, but the employers don't have the know-how in terms of how to move to value-based care. So the reality is there's a fundamental structural problem that you're not going to get over in commercial health.
And for our audience, ASO is administrative services.
No, you're right. You're right. I apologize. Basically the plans are just being paid to pay claims and contract for a network. But at the end of the day, they're really not, no offense, I'm used to work at Cigna, but no offense, they're not adding much value at all.
Yeah.
Because they have no incentive to. All the savings goes to the employer.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's part of the reason why it's been so important for ACOs to have certain provider governance.
Correct.
And historically, the ACOs, when first we've been learning about this space, the provider-driven ones have had the outcomes. It makes total sense.
Well, that's a good, but just as an aside point, though, doctors, it's governance, but it's also, and that this on this point, by the way, I think CMS is moving in the right direction, provider governance, but then it's also making sure the incentives flow down to the actual providers as physicians that are providing the care. So within the ASO, you still pay them on a volume basis. It's not going to work. You got to switch that around. So,
yeah,
absolutely. It's part of the governance issue.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Jeff, this has been such a pleasure. Thanks for making the time. I really, really enjoyed it.
Likewise, I could do this later. Actually, just as an aside, I got other physicians here who probably love to be in the podcast, so we can talk after this. But I like the fact that I just think I'm a doctor, so it's self-serving. I think we need more physician leaders to get the business side of this in the country.
That does it for this episode of The Doctor Is Out. Thanks for joining us. If you have any suggestions, feel free to reach out to us at info@tdio.org.